I have met with quite a lot of youth and civil society organizations working in the climate space over the last couple of years. And what I do get a sense of, without knowing any of the detail, is that they're quite small organizations. I don't get the sense of them being grounded in a widespread social movement. And I do think, if I was working in the NGO sector at this point in time, my question would be, what is it that needs to happen to translate this work into a much broader social movement around all of our collective futures? But I mean, I'm not in that world, so I can't answer for them. And I mean, it's not easy. Yes, but I am.
Throughout the series, we've often talked about climate change as a risk. And yes, it is. It's a risk to farmland, weather patterns, and the economy. But in South Africa, there is another risk we need to keep talking about. One that has come up repeatedly in this podcast. The risk of doing things in the dark. Yes, the government has been active in climate policy, often driven by political considerations. You've heard the term just transition discussed throughout this series. We've also spoken about laws like the Climate Change Act and how they are framed as part of South Africa's climate governance architecture.
But I do think that putting things on social media does not shift the world in a real way without active engagement with people on the ground. Leave aside my generation that is now heading into a preoccupation with its health and trying to work out what do we do for the last decades of our life. And one can support and play a role and do all kinds of things, but ultimately, there is a task that the youthful generations must take up, and must take up in a concerted way.
But here's the problem. If you look closely at these laws, they lack teeth and they lack coordination. They are not designed to act together in preparing for climate impacts or responding effectively when disasters strike. It is meant to be the country's main tool for climate action, yet it has limited enforcement power. If a large company continues to pollute, the law doesn't provide strong mechanisms to hold it accountable. It also doesn't require government to proactively share information. And perhaps most importantly, it does far too little for the people who are already bearing the brunt of extreme heat, flooding, and storms. Then there's the just part of the just transition. For any transition to be fair, people in affected communities need to be in the room. Their voices need to matter. But right now, the system isn't set up that way. We are seeing a serious lack of open data, which is simply a technical way of saying that we don't know where the money is going. We don't see the finance agreements, the timelines, or who is actually benefiting.
We need a climate social movement in South Africa that must be grounded in a commitment to improve the lives of ordinary people. And I see many small and fragmented initiatives happening that are all good in and of themselves. But the question of how do you pull them together into something that is big is a really big question.
When decisions are made behind closed doors, trust disappears. If the public can't follow the flow of money, people begin to suspect, often with good reason, that deals are being made for friends, relatives, or political allies. Opacity creates the perfect conditions for corruption. And when corruption takes hold, climate action fails. Policies get watered down, and money meant to save lives and build resilience ends up in the wrong pockets. So it's not enough to simply have climate policies. We need a system built on openness. We need institutions that answer to the people. If the system is neither transparent nor inclusive, then it is failing the very people it is supposed to serve.
That is the risk of activism, is that there have always been consequences for activism. Throughout history, it is a risk. You know, you stand up for a cause, power and agency has to be taken. No one's going to give it to you. You have to take it.
I'm Melusi Ngala, and this is In the Still of Night, a Corruption Watch podcast on climate change and corruption. This podcast series has taken us on a journey of learning and curiosity. Through our engagement with ordinary people, we were brought face to face with the daily realities of communities living with climate impacts. Myself and the team saw their lives, heard their stories, and walked through their communities, experiencing the rain, heat, and even if only briefly, the muddy conditions that make maintaining communal gardens nearly impossible. We wheezed, coughed, and scratched after exposure to dry, dusty conditions. But this is their everyday reality, regardless of our sympathies or the good intentions written into policies and laws. These are climate impacts happening now, not in some distant future. Therefore, because of this, improving climate governance is urgent. So how do we fix a broken system? It comes down to three major shifts. The voices we've heard, from national experts to grassroots activists, give us a clear picture of where solutions may lie. First, fix the laws. Right now, the Climate Change Act relies heavily on the Disaster Management Act, an older law with serious gaps. Parliament needs to step in. A dedicated parliamentary committee on climate change should be established. Key departments, including energy and environment, must regularly account to Parliament, showing that they are meeting targets and spending public money honestly. Joanne Yawich, who heads The Project Management Unit in the presidency acknowledges that giving climate law real teeth requires concrete action, particularly from the Department of Forestry, Fisheries, and the Environment.
The Climate Change Act is a framework act. For it to be implemented, it requires regulation. All of those different elements of it require detailed regulation that set out exactly how this will happen. So those regulations, as I understand it, are in development, and then they need to obviously go out for public consultation, and then they'll be promulgated. And once those are promulgated, we'll be able to see what the respective obligations and duties are and how government intends to implement and set up those accountability systems, including penalties for non-compliance, which will be set out, including for the process through which they'll set sector emission targets, the process through which the carbon budgets will be set, the reporting on greenhouse gas emissions overall, the reporting from individual companies on their compliance. All of that comes into the regulatory systems. In the same way as they regulate waste management regulations or air quality regulations, DFFE has to produce the regulations that give effect to the Act.
Bongani Johannes, Deputy Secretary General of Mining Affected Communities United in Action, provides a practical example of what meaningful regulation could look like in mining towns where pollution has long shaped daily life.
I hope that the situation changes, especially at the Department of Environment, inclusive of the Department of Minerals, because of most of what is happening here, they are the main contributors who were supposed to ensure that they enforce legislation to whoever was an emitter, whoever has been polluting. But now we don't have that. But if we can have a platform, it's either maybe a call center, a hotline, where maybe a community, if they experience something, they can go quickly to it to ensure that they are supported. Ours is to ensure that we organize communities, mobilize communities, and ensure that the little information we have in terms of legislative framework, we capacitate them with that.
Meanwhile, Tim Lloyd, a senior associate at Alt Advisory and Power and Associates, highlights how regulations must also address the role of business, particularly within the private sector.
I think around the issues of transparency, accountability, and fairness, an interesting movement in South Africa that's gained momentum off the back of Western jurisdictions, the US and the European Union regime come to mind in particular, is that of environmental and social governance. So simply, that's a company looking at the environmental and social risks of its business model, including its up and downstream supply chain, and then putting risk mitigation measures in place, monitoring those measures, and then disclosing them as well and reporting on them on a regular basis, and then having the necessary governance structures in place, key personnel, key performance indicators as well around ESG issues. So I think the interesting point to be made there is certainly in South Africa at the moment, these ESG frameworks and protocols are really voluntary. There's nothing that's mandated in our law. Of course, making up the ESG scene, we have our environmental law legal framework under NEMA, National Environmental Management Act, that's mandatory and requires compliance.
However, Mashudu Masuta, a legal researcher and expert in climate, environmental, and mining policy, argues that the Electricity Regulation Amendment Act should concern ordinary people most. Not only because of its corruption risks, discussed in episode 1, but because of its implications for social inequality in one of the most unequal countries in the world.
Electricity is already expensive. for most people, right? There are people who have access to electricity but do not have electricity because they cannot afford it, right? So when you start looking at the cost of renewable energy and you measure it up against the cost of coal per unit, it's almost triple. The assumption that because you're opening up a market and there's going to be multiple players, therefore the cost of electricity is going to be lower than with coal. It's a concerning assumption to make, because business is business. And if renewable energy sources is the only source of energy, then why would they go below a particular point? And it's expensive for them to generate that electricity in the first place. So they can't go below a particular point either. It has incredible socioeconomic impacts beyond facilitating corruption vulnerabilities.
The second action point, strengthen civil society participation. Civil society must play a stronger role in amplifying community voices and ensuring meaningful participation. This means moving beyond boardrooms and into communities, teaching people how to engage in public hearings and decision-making processes. This is what we call social accountability. Mashudu explains the kind of intervention civil society organizations need to take on.
That's where the role of civil society really comes into play. It comes into play with assisting with climate policy, public education, training of communities, helping them participate in the national disaster centers, and enabling a communication that's happening with people on the ground that are experiencing what they experience, and the people who are meant to develop the adaptation plans. Can't develop a plan unless what's happening in communities and what exactly they're experiencing. And changing the language a bit. You know, this adaptation and mitigation and all of that, those are big words that may not mean anything for communities that are actually experiencing the adversity.
If you didn't catch that, she's laughing at me quipping that these terms are even hard for me to grasp. Without access to expert knowledge and countless hours of reading, I would have been lost. So, what happens to communities with low literacy levels and limited access to information? They are far more vulnerable to being misled by officials or companies looking for quick approvals. Malik Dassault, climate researcher and Extinction Rebellion volunteer, raises similar concerns around people's participation in local government integrated development plan meetings.
The IDP processes that people are encouraged to go to and participate in, they are so inaccessible, right? I've been to them and I struggle to actually interact with the material being debated. It's highly technical. If you haven't been involved in the process, if you haven't been trained in it, there's not a lot that you can actually say that's going to be taken into account.
This reinforces the need for civil society organizations to intensify public education efforts. But Malik also points out the importance of advocacy within these spaces. It is for civil society to ensure accountability and genuine community participation.
There's two ways you make submissions into these processes. It's verbal and it's written. The verbal ones are when you participate in the meetings. We have no access to the minutes of those meetings. So we don't know if those facilitators have actually taken our inputs into consideration. We don't know how they've done so. We just see the report at the end saying, we consulted X, Y, and Z, and they raised these points. This is what we're going ahead with. So there's no sort of back and forth deliberation on how these processes are done. Massive oversight. And it also happens in award committee meetings. That's another platform where we can actually debate where these projects are going to take place. But what we see time and again is councillors not doing their mandates of providing spaces for these ward meetings. And so these things just happen unchecked. Or they'll say, well, here, we're going to this community on this day. They'll give the community a day's notice. And if you can't attend during work hours, then too bad.
Thabo Mululekwa, assistant editor at Oxpeckers, reminds us that civic action also includes whistleblowing. This is where journalists, as a crucial part of civil society, play a vital role in exposing wrongdoing.
Us as media, we are the first point of contact to people. The power of media is that when we start investigating, we start asking questions before we can even publish, while we are still in the interviewing process, the officials that acting start responding to such problems because they are scared to be exposed. So what I can tell people is that when you have that and we have all the information, go to your nearest media, go to media like us. We are investigating these environmental issues, go to us.
Finally, the third action point is that all of society needs to ensure that a no-secret policy is maintained. This must be applied to everybody. How does this look like? For government, ministers and members of the Climate Commission should publicly declare financial interests. For the private sector, companies bidding on green energy projects must disclose ownership structures. NGOs should also be transparent about their funding sources. But transparency also means following the money. It's been years since the Auditor General released a comprehensive report on climate-related spending. That is unacceptable. The Presidential Climate Commission and the Auditor General must track every cent and report back to the public. And when projects fail or money goes missing, there must be safe and accessible reporting mechanisms. Michael Marchant from Open Secrets, co-author of Who Has the Power? South Africa's Energy Profiteers, reinforces this point.
I think going forward in the future, this is probably one of the most important points for civil society and for the public to grapple with, is exactly this notion that the money comes in and goes often straight back out to companies, consultancies, and others that are based in those countries. And that's not just the case for South Africa. It's a global experience that is increasingly being identified, is that both the grant money that comes in and the loans are often not going into the local economic sector and architecture to build those industries. It's just not happening. And so often those powerful global north countries will trumpet how much money they've spent. But as you said, when you look at where that ends up, it's often very disappointing.
Even with the limited information currently available, there is already reason for concern.
There is currently a publicly accessible register of where the grant portion of the JET funding is going to. But if you look at where some of that JET grant money is going to, one of the programs that got funding was to do a gender-related project in Mpumalanga for women who were being affected by coal shutdowns and the just transition. The company that got that contract to do it was Deloitte, it's a consultancy, which, I mean, it's just, I find it flabbergasted that anyone looked at Deloitte and was like, there's where the expertise is, like those are the people that we can trust. But it's such a fantastic example of how there are so many grassroots organizations, activist groupings in Mpumalanga around the coalfields and the jet. And yet it looks like all of those were bypassed and they went to a massive auditing consulting firm and said, deliver us a report. That is a quintessential example of misspent money that is going clearly to the wrong place. And although I say that's one example, when you look through that grants register, it is the norm. It's the bigger firms, the consultancies, the other bigger firms, the global North nations feel that the money can be trusted with, who get the cash.
This strengthens the case for full transparency around contracts, pricing, and grant and loan agreements.
We should all, as the public, have access to those things as status quo. Unfortunately, at the moment, both companies and the state hide behind commercial interests and commercial confidentiality to say, we can't tell you anything. And that really undermines efforts for accountability.
Beyond these three action points, several contributors also reflected on broader approaches to improving climate governance. During her travels documenting community stories, climate writer and journalist Leonie Hubert shared this message for government officials.
The one thing I would like them to hear is that they need to find ways to support people and institutions and communities on the ground who are doing the work so that we can have a just transition. If there are communities and individuals and small businesses that are trying to keep the local economy alive, trying to keep the environment healthy, trying to keep the community healthy, find ways to support them through education support, small business development, any startup funding to help the small enterprises get going. There needs to be a quick, easy way for people who are low resourced, but they've got the skill, they've got the vision, they've got the model for how they want the community intervention to work, but they're doing it on the smell of an oil rag often. If there were ways for these individuals and communities to tap into resources that would just boost them so that they can do the work themselves, that's what I would like our policymakers to hear.
Surplus People's Project's Wade Parker echoes Leonie's sentiments, including those mentioned earlier.
You have communities, you have the rural communities that's really organizing and trying to build alternatives from below. It's working. Where this includes different ways of farming, agroecology, where this includes creating localized food systems, because what's happening, climate change has an impact on food access as well. We have these pockets of alternatives emerging from the ground level, but it's not enough. So where you have these alternatives emerging from ground level, you still need the appropriate policies and laws in place to support these local initiatives. The fact that that's not in place yet makes these alternatives extremely difficult and extremely slow. So we are still in this cycle of devastation and we are just continuously struggling. State has to put in place certain policies to back the work up of local communities. But to amplify this work, to make this climate change action relevant to communities, it's really a call for transparency and community participation.
And finally, from the communities themselves, what are the people hoping for?
I think indlela engabalula eyokuthi sithole ama leaders athembekile.
Access to information for our people, because you cannot address something that you don't know.
Ngafisa wangathi nalabo abasemkhukhwini kushintshe kube neproject ezobakhela izindlu njengama RDP, nabakhona ukuthola nabo ukusebenzisa le nto. Of course, mabasebenzisa zona lezi amalahle, still vele umoya uzongona ngale ntuthu.
I think we need to be educated, because this was just the start.
And we need to know what's going on around us. We need to know how to act. And like you said, we must know what to do. Climate change is here to stay. So we have to be prepared to save and to help and to prevent.
These voices reminded me of a conversation with Transparency International's Gwanza Gwertateli about how we approach climate governance as a whole.
A lot of the problems that we are facing when we talk about climate action, it's not much different from the problems that we are anyways facing in the society. So as long as we don't fool ourselves and think that just because we are doing something for the good of the planet, things will be different, we should be good to go, because we already have a lot of knowledge about what problems we have in our given societies or given localities. And all of these are still relevant when we talk about the climate crisis or climate action, because these problems will not go away just because we have this good mission to save the planet. We should make sure that there's a strong oversight, there's transparency in how things are done, how decisions are made, how policies are made. We should make sure that the interests of poor or marginalized communities are on the table and it's not overrun by already powerful groups making their demands and benefiting from changes that we are witnessing.
Ultimately, climate governance integrity should not be a buzzword. It is about ensuring that the just transition is truly just, and that the most vulnerable are protected when climate disasters strike. In the Still of Night is hosted, written, and executive produced by me, Melusinana. Music and sound engineering by DJ Darkness. Production management by Moira Campbell as head of communications at Corruption Watch. Additional thanks to the Corruption Watch team, namely Sboniso Nyite, Tawanda Kaseke and Janine Erasmus, for their field work assistance. Thank you as well to the community members who shared their stories and the experts whose contributions enriched our knowledge. To you, listener, there would be no reason to produce this series, so many thanks for lending us an ear. Please don't forget to subscribe and share the podcast with others and tell us what you think of it. This podcast is funded by the Waverley Street Foundation through Transparency International Secretariat. For more information and resources, visit www.corruptionwatch.org.za.